Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. It was a brazen and violent attack by North Korean forces on an American ship sailing in international waters, leading to the death of one sailor and the imprisonment of the remaining 82 crewmen, who were confined and tortured for 11 long months. Yet the capture of the spy ship, the USS Pueblo, the only active-duty vessel of the United States Navy, still held in captivity by a foreign government, remains a largely forgotten chapter in American naval history. We have this special report by Tim Whale.
The ones that got us that just came through the side of the ship and just blew up. I knew something was wrong, but your mind getting shot's a little strange. Your mind just sort of refuses to acknowledge that something was going on. And so I just wanted to get more steel between me and the bullets.
50 years ago, at the height of the Cold War, an American naval vessel was attacked in the icy North Pacific by the world's most secretive communist state.
The North Koreans wanted the U.S. to admit that we were in their territorial waters spying on them.
The crew of more than 80 young servicemen was taken prisoner and subjected to a terrifying 11-month ordeal.
They told him that they're going to start shooting one man a day, starting with the youngest man. Start shooting one man a day until Pete confessed.
The ship was the USS Pueblo. Its capture was a major embarrassment for the United States and triggered a serious international crisis. Yet half a century on, the Pueblo incident has been almost totally forgotten. And this is the story of the Pueblo, one of very few US ships to have been captured in the last 200 years, the only commissioned American vessel still in enemy hands.
When most Navy ships go out to sea, they go in a convoy. There'll be six or eight ships with mutual support systems and things, so if one had a problem, then the others would be there to help. But we went out alone.
That's Bob Chica, then 23, a Korean language specialist. The Pueblo was a refitted cargo ship, its lonely task to eavesdrop on communist communications.
That was our main mission, was to intercept their transmissions, to intercept their Morse code messages.
Don McLaren, aged 33, was a communications technician.
So you were spying on them?
Basically, yes. Yes, we were. All countries do this. I like to call it a gentleman's game. You know, you don't mess with me, I won't mess with you.
In the dead of winter, January 1968, the Pueblo was operating off the coast of North Korea.
You can see the coast,
what
yeah.
What did they look like?
Dunny Tuck, then 30, was an oceanographer, one of only two civilians on board.
It was mountainous. North Korea is pretty mountainous, and we were close enough, you know, 15 miles off, to see the mountains of North Korea.
15 nautical miles was enough to keep them beyond the 12-mile international territorial limit. Enough, they hoped, to keep them out of trouble.
No one paid any attention to us at all until the day before, when a couple of their fishing vessels happened to find us.
They'd been detected, and North Korea's Navy wasn't far behind.
I saw one subchaser come up really close.
Steve Walk, then just 18, was a naval engineer.
I remember the swells of the water, you know, they come up and they made a turn and just a big old wave come towards the ship.
Dunny Tuck saw a succession of naval boats approach.
Seven boats came out, a couple of them were gunboats, bigger boats, but four torpedo boats was out circling us. And I was looking out there and here these little sailors are out on this torpedo boat. They were close enough. They were within 50 to 75 feet pointing their rifles and said, bang, bang, bang.
The Americans were outnumbered and outgunned. All the captain, Pete Booker, could do was to try to get away. Dunny Tuck was with him on the bridge.
That's what Pete was saying when he came in. He said, these guys said they're going to open fire if we don't let them aboard. And he said, I'm not going to let them aboard. I want to steam out further out.
Down in the comms room, Don McLaren and his team were frantically trying to get an SOS to the nearest U.S. naval base in Japan.
We were giving a running narrative of what was happening, and we kept getting our position and transmitting that back because we didn't want any doubt where we were at. And all the operator at the other end would say, well, we're trying to get you help now. But there was a chain of command.
The Pueblo was running out of time.
And they found that they couldn't hit us with their machine gun fire because of the way we had it arranged. So that's when they opened up with the bigger shells on us. Many of them would just dent the ship and things like that, but many of them came through the ship too.
Below deck, in smoke-filled corridors, the crew were attempting to burn the Pueblo's piles of secret documents, all this as the shells pounded the boat.
So when you're trying to dodge them at the same time as destroying stuff?
There's no dodging them. You either get hit by it or you won't.
Bob was hit, though he tried to shrug it off.
When I was saying that, I was thinking in my head, who the hell are you kidding? You know, there's something wrong. And then I got shot in the leg, took off the bottom of my scrotum and then into my leg. And, something's wrong. And so you reach down and come back with a handful of blood.
Steve Walk was alongside Bob when one of the shells landed.
About that time, a 57mm came through the side of the ship where Bob Chica and Dwayne Hodges and Charlie Crandall were working, and it blew up. And I was down in another corridor, and Dwayne Hodges took most of the blast to his waist. It literally blew his leg off at the hip. What they did with Dwayne from that point on, I don't know. We never saw him again.
Did you know he was dead?
Yeah, I knew he had died. I got a pretty good charge of shrapnel. Blew me over backwards. I do remember a real burning sensation, just a dull pain. I ended up with a fractured pelvis. One testicle was pretty much disintegrated from the shrapnel. The other one was damaged bad enough that they both had to be surgically removed at that time. I had two holes through me about the size of my thumb.
The North Koreans had soon encircled the Pueblo and come alongside.
They came aboard and then they ordered everybody at topside and they start beating people, blindfold us and start tying our hands.
So it sounds like real panic.
There was really no panic. I don't think it really set in what was going on. It was like, okay, they're going to hit us, and then they're going to let us go. But that never happened. When they came aboard, we were still destroying equipment and paperwork. But then, I forget who it was, made the announcement over the ship's intercom system for us to report back to the mess decks. The crew was calm. And the North Koreans were just standing there guarding us. And that's where I had my last cup of coffee for 11 months. I went over and got a cup of coffee and standing there drinking it.
The 82 surviving crew of the Pueblo had been taken prisoner without firing a single shot to defend themselves.
What we accomplished is that we'd kill a couple, they'd kill a couple, and then they'd back off and sink the ship. If we saw a couple of U.S. fighters flying over and sinking a couple of their ships, it might have been a different thing on not fighting off the boarding party, if we saw a reason. But if it's just going to be suicide.
The Pentagon, bogged down in Vietnam, was unable or unwilling to defend the Pueblo. Within a couple of hours, the North Koreans were in control of the ship. Steve Walk lay in agony below deck.
I was put up on the dining room table. Couldn't move. I couldn't do nothing. And the pain was slowly starting to set in then. I have no idea how long I laid there before a couple Korean guards come in, one at my head, one on my feet, and wrapped me up in that plastic blanket and just drug me off the table and down the corridor. The next thing I knew, they put me in a bus.
The ship had been brought into the port of Wonsan.
And when they put me in the bus, they just slid me in on the floor, and all the rest of the crewmen were there. And I literally think I was the last man on the Pueblo.
Well, it is certainly soon, Defense Secretary Dean Rusk's reaction to the ship's capture was leading the news.
Of course, the seizure of an official naval vessel of another country in international waters and taking it into your port is a very harsh act, and I would not object to designating it as an act of war.
One morning, there was only one station on the television that was in English because we were living in Japan. And I thought I heard the word Pueblo, and I thought, there's no way I heard the Pueblo on there.
Pat Kell's husband, Jim, was one of the captured sailors.
And then pretty soon somebody knocked on my door, and my neighbor came over.
What did they say?
They said, guess what, your husband's ship has been captured. Of course, I was stunned. I was beside myself.
My strong advice to North Korea is to cool it. There have been enough of these incidents. We'd like to see the Russians give us some help in this matter and get this ship out of there.
But Russia's influence over its ally, North Korea, was waning. In the meantime, Bob Chicker and his fellow crew were imprisoned near the North Korean capital, Pyongyang, accused of spying.
At that point, they weren't sure they were going to keep us alive or what they were going to do. The first place they took us, we called the barn. It was just temporary. They kept us there for about 40 days. It was absolutely filthy. There was one bathroom you could use sometimes. It had Japanese-type toilets in the floor that they might flush once a day. So if you got in there, you know, there'd be a pile of crap, you know, a foot high.
But worse than that, they were afraid they'd soon be dead.
I was sitting there, I was looking at this officer, and he pulled a gun out, and he went click.
Right in your face?
Yeah. I don't remember anything after that.
You kind of blanked out?
Yeah. That will stand out in my life forever, you know. Everybody had their own experience, and I guess everybody handled them differently.
Meanwhile, as some of the men faced mock executions, the wounded, including Steve Walk and Bob Chicker, were finally being treated after a fashion.
It was 10 days before we really got any type of major medical attention. They come in one night, took me into this room, took that plastic cover off of me, peeled it off of me, and tied my hands and wrists, tied my legs to the table and started operating on me. They removed a small handful of shrapnel with no anesthetic. The thing that I remember most is taking the scissors and they was just cutting the dead skin away. The operation probably lasted less than 15 minutes, but it seemed like forever.
I suspect we were dying. They pulled several tables out of our cells and then had me bring my bed sheet down to this room, and I had six guys holding my legs, and then they operated and took it out.
Holding your legs just because of the pain to keep you still?
Yeah. And I had no idea what to do, you know. I'm thinking, this can't be for real. And I was wondering what to do with my hands, because I didn't want to jerk and screw things up here. So eventually one of the guards just had me hold my pillow. And so they took it out. And that's it's embedded in my memory. I could draw a picture of it. Kind of made a mess.
Gotcha.
And then sewed me up with two stitches, a heavy cord type thing, sort of like we use to tie up a round roast here before we cook it. And the two stitches made as big a scar as the wound itself. And then gave me my bloody sheets and sent me back to my cell.
I went through hell every day because I didn't know what was happening to my husband. I didn't know if he was dead or alive.
Pat Kell was waiting and praying in her family quarters on a military base.
Every day for me was hell. I never cried in front of my children. I waited till I went to bed, and I just cried and cried.
The Americans' guards and tormentors kept them alive, But perhaps that's partly because North Korean dictator Kim Il-sung needed them for propaganda purposes. He wanted a public confession of guilt.
After the severe beatings and getting confessions out of us, which we all held up, you know, as long as possible, they said, "Captain, we know what you're doing. You might as well confess and make it public, or what they told him, we're going to start shooting the youngest man up. Every day you're going to lose a man."
So just say it again. What exactly did they tell him?
They told him that they're going to start shooting one man a day, starting with the youngest man. Start shooting one man a day until Pete confessed. So he did. He had to make a taped confession that the ship was a spy ship, you know, basically, trying to gather intelligence. And he had to add certain things in there that made it good for the Koreans. We never were in their waters, but he had to confess that he was in their waters.
Others, too, apologized for the TV cameras.
"Since I was arrested, I thought again and again about my criminal act. What I have done against the government of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, I humbly beg of you to forgive me my crime."
What they really felt guilty about, though, was failing to stand up to the pressure, allowing themselves to be used.
The feeling is, why couldn't I have held out longer? Why couldn't I have resisted longer? You can only do so much. I think the body and the mind can only take so much.
And as the weeks of captivity turned into months, they had to take more and more. America was negotiating for their release, but the talks kept stalling. Kim Il-sung wanted President Lyndon Johnson's administration to apologise in writing for spying, but the White House refused.
Like they say about flying, it's endless hours of boredom punctuated by moments of sheer terror. And that's a good description of being a POW. The isolation, the close quarters, the lack of food, lack of mental stimulation, all that kind of stuff was frequently much more difficult to deal with than actually getting beat on.
They did feed us. They brought what they called food three times a day.
What was it?
Rotten turnip soup, stale bread. They did have rice and apples, surprisingly. Every apple I ever ate over there had a worm in it. The first one I turned away. From then on, I kept eating the apples. Just, and worm and all, getting my protein. Well, we got hot for breakfast, we had warm for lunch, and cold for supper.
I was in with Steve Wolk. We ended up in the same cells. And Steve is a singer. And yes, he taught us some songs. "We gotta get out of this place." That was one of them. "We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. This girl is a better life for me and you."
If their guards had heard of the Animals, they didn't let on. North Korea in the 1960s was swinging to another beat, the slogans of the so-called great leader, Kim Il-sung.
They might give us some literature and they might want to talk about something trying to convert us.
Well, like speeches of like Kim Il-sung and things.
Yeah, well, good old Kim Il-sung. He's God incarnate. You never would say Kim Il-sung. You had to precede it or follow it by some long-winded eulogy. I memorized one just for the hell of it. "Peerless patriot, national hero, ever victorious, iron-willed, genius commander, and one of the international communist and working class movement's leader, Marshal Kim Il-sung said."
Did they try and get you to say that?
No. I just memorized it because I wanted to bring it back.
But the crew, despite their isolation and the beatings, still found small ways to show defiance.
We were given the finger all the time. And I guess that's in England, too,
yeah.
The middle finger.
Well, middle finger, like up in
there.
Yeah.
We were given the bird and everything, and we told them.
Giving the bird. In many propaganda photos that the North Koreans circulated, the crew were extending their middle fingers. Time magazine spotted the gesture and printed a picture with the comment,
"The North Koreans are having a hard time proving to the world that the captured crewmen of the USS Pueblo are a contrite and cooperative lot. Last week, Pyongyang's flak tried again and lost. In this class reunion picture, three of the crewmen have managed to use the medium for a message, furtively getting off the U.S. hand signal of obscene divisiveness and contempt.
When the North Korean authorities read that, Don McLaren and his crewmates were really in for it.
It was a 1 week of pure hell. They brought in a special squad, and we were fair game. I mean, we were beat, and beat.
It lasted a couple of weeks, and they were really pissed. They put us through the worst stuff since we'd been there during that period of time. And then,
what does that mean?
The beatings and the rotten food and just on you 24/7. I mean, it was just a bad time. Then all of a sudden, it stopped.
Unknown to the prisoners, 11 months of negotiations had finally ended successfully. With Christmas just a few days away, the US administration agreed to sign a letter admitting guilt. It soon retracted it, but it was enough to allow both sides to claim victory.
President Johnson and I are pleased to report that the United States representative at Panmunjom John has just obtained the release of 82 officers and men of the USS Pueblo, who last January were illegally seized with their ship on the high seas. The body of seaman Duane D. Hodges, who lost his life at the time the ship was captured, has also been returned.
And almost as suddenly as their captivity began, the men were on their way to freedom, taken to the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea.
You know you're going to be released.
You look out at the officer who has the clipboard, and you don't move till he tells you to. And when he nodded, you stepped off and turned left and started walking you over the bridge.
The long bridge?
Yeah, the bridge of no return.
But when we got across, what did the U.S. do? They put us on a bus and took us to the end of the DMZ, had a big tent set up. And what do we get? Cheeseburgers, french fries, and milkshakes. And it all there for us. And I got on the planes the next day and headed for Miramar Naval Air Station in San Diego and got us there right before Christmas.
And the crew has now been released in time to have Christmas with their loved ones. I'm very pleased at this result.
On Christmas Eve, 1968, dignitaries, well-wishers and family, including Pat Kell, were waiting on the runway.
We run to each other and the kids are hugging him and he looks like crap. Oh, God, he was so skinny. When I saw him, I cried. How could I talk? I cried and hugged him and I couldn't.
The positive reaction we got when we got home really surprised us. It was an amazing time. We were looked on as heroes, and we thought that we would be really in a lot of trouble. The Navy did not like us being made heroes. They very much liked to, it's your fault, you know, and define things that way. But the public was so on our side, it was amazing. When we got back to San Diego, they took us into Miramar. And the traffic, whew, some of it was pretty emotional. But the traffic was actually stopped on the streets. All the cars pulled off to the side and everyone went out there waving at us. A wild time, Christmas Eve, too.
But after the celebrations came the recriminations. Naval commanders didn't want to take the rap, even though they sent the Pueblo, ill-equipped and ill-prepared, on the riskiest of missions. Captain Pete Booker was accused of surrendering without a fight, but blaming the captain outraged crew members like Pat's husband, Jim Kell.
He never really gave up the ship. There was just no way we could stop them from boarding. We didn't have the weapons. We were totally outnumbered. We had virtually no armament to fight back, and there was no way we were going to get away. If he'd have kept on going, every one of us would have been killed.
They wanted to court-martial Booker. right off the bat for giving up the ship without a fight. And from what I understand, one of the admirals at the Court of Inquiry made the comment, if you'd only fired one shot and drew blood, you all be heroes. Well, there's quite a bit of blood shed on our side.
It's important for people to know because of what we went through. I don't want it to be for nothing. I want them to know what heroes these men were. They do not consider themselves heroes. They do not. He said we were just doing our job. But he has never been the same. Neither of us have been the same. When you've gone through that, you look different, you feel different, you act different, and you always have PTSD.
Today, 50 years on, former members of the crew and their families still do their best to keep the memory of the Pueblo alive. And so too, in a very different spirit, do their former tormentors.
Pueblo is a U.S. armed spy ship, which was captured by the heroic Korean People's Army in January 1968, while committing espionage acts in territorial waters of the DPRK.
That's the commentary North Korean school children hear as they tour the Victorious War Museum in Pyongyang, where the Pueblo is the prize exhibit. And as long as they do for Don McLaren, one of the oldest of the surviving crew, the story of the ship that sailed alone is still not over.
The only thing I really want out of North Korea is I want the ship out of there. Because when they take the ship, if they was ever to release it, the U.S. could decommission it, and I think this whole crew would be home. Would be home then. Would all be at peace.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Let us know where and how you heard the program. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com, or you can also send an email to our general email account for PCJ, which is pcjmedia@gmail.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, thanks so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.